Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after killing three people there. The Russian defense minister is visiting North Korea for talks aimed at boosting bilateral cooperation. And dozens of people are killed in several countries as wildfires triggered by heat waves rage on in three continents. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces have killed yet another young Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank, bringing to four the number of fatalities in the past 24 hours. The regime's troops raided the Al Ain refugee camp in the city of Nablus. The attack left one Palestinian dead and several others injured. Just a day ago, Israeli forces shot dead three Palestinians in the same city. They claimed the slain men had fired at soldiers. The West Bank cities of Nablus and Jenin have been the scenes of daily Israeli raids. Over the past couple of months, the regime claims it targets Palestinians involved in anti-Israel operations. Those operations have increased in retaliation for Israel's deadly crackdown against the Palestinians. The regime has killed over 200 Palestinians this year so far. Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah with all the latest from the occupied West Bank. Mona, bring us up to speed on the recent Israeli regime's raid at the Al Ain refugee camp in the city of Nablus.
Israeli forces have raided Al Ain refugee camp in Nablus, northern the occupied West Bank, and surrounded a house. And they claim that Palestinian fighters were hiding inside this house, and they are accused of planning to carry out anti-Israeli operations, or that they are responsible for a series of shooting against Israeli forces and Israeli settlers in that area. One Palestinian was arrested during this raid in Nablus. However, clashes had erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian people, residents of the refugee camp, who tried their utmost in order to fight the Israeli forces and to force them out of Al Ain refugee camp. At least one Palestinian was killed during this military raid. 23-year-old Muhammad Abdel Hakim Nada was shot in the chest, and Palestinian paramedics said that he succumbed to his injuries. The Israeli forces had also imposed a closure and sealed up all the entrances to Al Ain refugee camp and prevented anyone to enter the refugee camp or leave it.
Mona, let's also talk about the international silence with regards to the continued Israeli aggression and violence that's being carried out against Palestinians on a day-to-day basis. How do Palestinians feel about this international inaction?
Israeli military claims that every time they raid Palestinian areas, it's in order to arrest Palestinians whom they accuse they are wanted for security reasons, or that they took part in peaceful demonstrations. This is, in the first place, is against the international law. All laws had guaranteed the people living under occupation to defend themselves. This is what's going on. Palestinians are defending themselves. They prevent the Israeli forces to arrest them, to kill them, destroy their homes, seize their lands. However, nothing is received by the Palestinians but condemnation from the international community. The international community, the European Union, see very well the Israeli crimes and the Israeli aggression, and they only condemn these practices and they call on the Israeli regime to stop it. Palestinians, at the end of the day, are fed up from these condemnations. This is why they urge and keep urging the international community to translate their words into actions. They had been repeatedly demanding the international community to take actions against the Israeli regime, to impose sanctions against Netanyahu's regime. However, they know very well that while the Israeli regime is backed by the United States, then the international community will do nothing but to issue more condemnations and be silent in front of the non-stop crimes being committed against the Palestinians.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. A new survey shows nearly one-third of Israelis are considering moving abroad amid concerns over the passing of an unpopular judicial reform bill. According to the poll conducted by an Israeli broadcaster, over half of those surveyed said they fear the overhaul could harm Israel's security. A similar number of respondents said they are worried about a civil war. This and another survey also predicted that Netanyahu's far-right ruling coalition would lose its majority if elections were held today. The latest surveys reflect a deep crisis within Israel. The divide over the new legislation has even spread to the regime's military, with volunteer reservists saying they will not report for duty. Former top brass has also warned about weakness in Israel's military. The Netanyahu coalition pushed ahead with reforms despite continuous mass protests. Political analyst Bruce Katz believes that the existing divisions within the Israeli society led to the collapse of the apartheid regime there.
What the situation is at this point in time is really something of a catharsis. This is the crumbling of the apartheid regime. It remains to be seen just how long they'll be able to hold on, because there's also internal divisions and strong ones within Likud itself. For example, the defense minister Yoav Gallant. But this can be an opportunity for Palestinians and progressive Israelis to form some sort of a political movement between them, to perhaps based on the idea of one democratic state from the river to the sea. I've always been of the opinion that the only way to bring down the apartheid regime in Israel is a joint Palestinian-Israeli Arab-Jewish coalition. And right. Perhaps that's what will come out of this. We'll have to wait and see.
Iran says Israel is to blame for the recent sacrilegious acts against the Holy Quran in Europe.
The hidden hands of the Zionist regime can be seen behind the sedition of insulting the Holy Quran. Of course, this reality does not lessen the responsibility of those governments that facilitate these insults, and they must be held accountable and act responsibly. These governments had better not sacrifice their interests, credit, and prestige for the interests of the Zionist regime.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman also said the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has agreed to hold an emergency meeting to discuss the desecration in Sweden and Denmark. Kanani said the OIC ministerial meeting will take place virtually on Monday following the sacrilege. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, called for an OIC meeting in phone conversations with his counterparts in some Islamic countries. Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution in the wake of the desecration of the Quran. The resolution deplores all acts of profanity against holy books as a violation of international law. Earlier, Palestinian activist Moti Abu Mosabeh joined us from Gaza City to tell us about the reason behind the Quran desecration in the West.
It's undeniable that there is a wave of racism that is overwhelming the majority of European countries, and indeed this goes hand in hand with the merge of the right-wing groups and parties in those countries. So all these appalling acts that we are witnessing nowadays are a direct repercussion and translation of the attitudes of those right-wing groups and those racist groups and parties. So it's not bizarre, it's not surprising that these acts are actually happening nowadays in the European countries. And I think all this is stemming from the racist attitude that those right-wing groups and parties actually have and hold against other nations, other countries, other religions, as you know, because they do believe in their white supremacy, and this means that they need to disgrace and they need to disrespect and belittle any other beliefs and other religions and other nations as a whole. The major part of this situation is totally about the racist attitude that is overwhelming the European countries, protected by the governments, which are totally affiliated and from the right-wing groups with their beliefs, with their racist beliefs, and with their racist attitudes against the other people. And part of that attitude and part of that act, actually, is highly related to the political situation and the political agendas of those religious and right-wing groups and governments.
The Russian defense minister, who is on a visit to North Korea, says Moscow and Pyongyang plan to strengthen their defense cooperation. Sergei Shoigu made the remarks after holding talks with his North Korean counterpart, who expressed full support for the Russian army and people. Shoigu is leading a delegation to North Korea to attend the 70th anniversary of an armistice that ended the Korean War. A Chinese delegation will also take part in the July 27th event, which is expected to include a massive military parade in Pyongyang. North Korea celebrates the anniversary of the 1953 armistice as Victory Day. The war broke out between the two Koreas in 1950 and left millions of people dead. Two neighbors are still technically at war because their conflict ended in an armistice rather than a peace treaty. Russia is blaming Ukraine for conducting two drone attacks on the country's capital, Moscow. Russia said it had repelled the attacks successfully and there were no casualties. Meanwhile, Ukraine has admitted that it had attacked Moscow using UAVs, stressing it would increase the number of such attacks against Russia. The new development could further complicate the prospect of reaching a peaceful solution to the war.
Early Monday, two drones targeted the Russian capital, Moscow. Soon after, in a rare admission of responsibility for attacks inside Russia, Ukrainian military intelligence warned such attacks on the Russian capital city will continue an increase in scale. In a comment to the Ukrainian newspaper Kyiv Post, a Ukrainian military intelligence spokesman named Andriy Yusov said, "The strikes on the key facilities of Russia's security sector located in Moscow testify to the fact that the Putin regime is unable to fully control the sky even for the protection of the most important facilities. Obviously, this situation will continue an increase in scale." Russian Defense Ministry said it had used electronic warfare systems and caused the two drones to crash. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin said the drones crashed into two non-residential buildings, adding that there was no serious damage or casualties. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova called the drone attack an act of international terrorism. The operations risk a major escalation, especially if Russia believes the US and NATO are backing the attacks. This is the second time that Kyiv has attempted to attack Moscow facilities with unmanned aerial vehicles this month. On July 4th, Ukraine launched a five-drone strike, which also failed. Back then, the Russian Foreign Ministry said that Ukrainian drone attacks on Moscow and other areas inside Russia would not be possible without support from the US and NATO. The ministry also accused the US and NATO of training drone operators and providing the necessary intelligence to launch such operations. It is not clear if the US and NATO are enabling drone attacks inside Russia, but there are signs the Western powers are involved in some way. Following drone attacks on Russian airbases in December 2022, an Asia Times report cited military sources in NATO countries who said the drones used US satellite GPS data to hit their targets. US military equipment has also been used in attacks on Russian territory. A cross-border attack in Russia's Belgorod region was launched on May 22nd, using US armored vehicles and NATO rifles.
Wildfires triggered by extreme heat waves continue to claim lives while forcing thousands to flee their homes in many countries across the world. Scorching weather is gripping three continents, whipping up wildfires in countries including Syria, Italy, Greece, Portugal, Croatia, Spain, France, Algeria, and Tunisia. Nearly three dozen people have been killed in the blazes in Algeria. Italy has reported seven deaths, while three were killed in neighboring Greece. The blazes, many of them out of control, have destroyed homes, forests, and agricultural land. Thousands of firefighters are struggling to contain the blazes, with some countries deploying army personnel to help fire extinguishing crews. That's a wrap for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. It is narrated that after Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam returned to Medina from Karbala, maybe 10 or 11 months passes between the time this caravan left Medina and returned, a person visited him and said, "O son of the Messenger of Allah, you see, you went and what happened?" He was right. The caravan had left while Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the bright son of Ahlul Bayt, so much loved by the Messenger of Allah, was among them, leading them. The daughter of Imam Ali alayhi salam had left while she was dignified and honored. The children of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Abbas and others, the children of Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, prominent and talented youths of Bani Hashem, had all left with this caravan. But the caravan returned with only one man, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, with the women gone through sufferings of captivity and the loss of their loved ones. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Hazrat Ali al-Akbar, and even the baby were now gone. Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam answered that man stating, "Imagine what would have happened if we had not gone." Yes, if they had not gone, their bodies might have survived, but the truth would have died. The soul would have died out. Consciences would have been shattered. Logic and reason would have been condemned throughout history. And even the name of Islam would not have remained.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Why did Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam take his family to Karbala? Why didn't he refuse to fight with several thousand fighter army of Yazid, in spite of having only 72 people in his army? Why didn't he try other methods? Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him. Like the day of Mubahala, it was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The supply of cluster munitions to Kyiv is complicating the situation of Ukraine conflict. In the latest development, the governor of Russia's Belgorod region said Ukraine fired cluster munitions at a village near the Ukrainian border on Friday. Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov said three cluster munitions and more than 20 artillery shells were fired at the village of Zhuravlevka. In a separate incident, Russian journalist Rostislav Zhuravlev was killed on Saturday in Ukraine's southeastern Zaporizhia region.
On July the 22nd, 2023, AFU units launched an artillery strike on a group of journalists from the Izvestia and the RIA Novosti news agencies. As a result of the strike with cluster munitions, four journalists were wounded to varying degrees of severity. During the evacuation, a journalist from the RIA Novosti news agency died from his injuries.
Reacting to the deadly assault, Russia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations said the attack had crossed all moral red lines. In a separate reaction, the Russian foreign ministry described Zhuravlev's death as a heinous premeditated crime committed by Western powers in Kyiv. Russia's foreign ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova denounced what she called criminal terror, adding that the attack appeared deliberate. Russia's investigative committee said it had launched a criminal probe into the killing of the journalist. It said that as part of the investigation, investigators will establish all the circumstances of the crime against media representatives as well as those involved. The reactions come as Ukraine received cluster bombs from the United States earlier this month. Kyiv repeatedly said the use of cluster munitions will be limited to the battlefield, pledging that it will use them only to dislodge concentrations of enemy soldiers. Cluster munitions contain scores of small bomblets that rain shrapnel over a wide area but are banned in more than 100 countries due to the potential danger they pose to civilian lives. The use of cluster munitions to Ukraine comes as Western countries are hell-bent to provide Ukraine as much support as financially possible. It was just on Thursday when the European Union pledged an over $22 billion aid for Ukraine's defense.
We propose the creation of a dedicated section under the European Peace Facility to provide up to 5 billion euros a year for the next 4 years for the defense needs of Ukraine.
Borrell presented the proposal to EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. The plan is set to be debated in detail next month. The EU has so far provided $5.6 billion in military assistance to Ukraine for the war with Russia. Meanwhile, the United States on Wednesday announced a new $1.3 billion military aid package for Ukraine, featuring air defense systems, anti-tank missiles, drones, and other equipment. Washington also said it plans to announce a new military aid package for Ukraine worth up to $400 million. The aid is primarily comprised of artillery, air defense missiles, and ground vehicles. The security assistance package will be the 43rd approved by the United States for Ukraine since the war began in February 2022. U.S. officials said cluster munitions are not included in the new weapons assistance package. Washington, however, first sent dual-purpose improved conventional munitions to Ukraine earlier this month. The supply of such weapons brought Washington's total aid to Ukraine to more than $42 billion since the Ukraine war began. In total, the United States and its allies have pledged to provide Ukraine with numerous military aid packages worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Those weapons are sent to Kiev regardless of the fact that Russia has time and again warned that such an assistance would only prolong the conflict. Those aids not only have failed to prevent the conflict from getting exacerbated, but instead led to even more escalation on both sides. By supplying Ukraine with the internationally banned cluster munitions, the United States is taking a huge risk. Apart from prolonging the war, which Russia has numerously warned against, the supply of cluster munitions to Ukraine has the potential risk of turning the conflict into a war at a global scale. That's what many are already concerned about, what they term World War III, with its own catastrophic consequences. Britain is hit with yet another wave of strikes over wages, job cuts, and working conditions. In the latest series of such strike actions, more than 20,000 rail workers walked out of their jobs on Thursday. Workers from 14 train companies took part in the strike organized by Britain's largest specialist transport trade union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime, and Transport Workers. Many of those on strike complained that the sustained price rises for core products in the UK has made it increasingly difficult for the working class to make ends meet.
Inflation over the last few months has been absolutely rampant. A lot of working class people are struggling. And over the last 30 months, we've been taking a stand to try and change the way the government is approaching its treatment of working people.
Strikers were also concerned about losing their jobs altogether.
The last couple of weeks, the government has issued over 2,000 Section 188 redundancy notices to railway colleagues working in ticket offices, and they want to close every single ticket office in the country, in the United Kingdom.
Strikers said although the union members feel sorry that withholding their labour could impact people's travel plans during peak holiday season, they simply could not find any better way to express their dissatisfaction.
We always regret causing the disruption we do when we strike. We do apologise to every member of the public who's been affected by them.
The strike coincided with the last day of a week-long overtime ban by train drivers in Asluff. The strike action caused misery and travel disruptions for many across London and several other cities, with most of the 14 affected train operators run roughly half of their normal timetables. The strikes also hit cross-border trains serving Wales and Scotland, where staff were not directly in dispute. UK authorities warned that some disruptions was likely to continue into Sunday. The last in the series of three 24-hour strikes planned by the RMF comes next Saturday, 29th of July. The strike by railway workers come as Britain has been hit by similar such actions for the past year, with NHS staff being among main government employees calling for better wages and working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20th and 21st. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain. The recent walkout by senior doctors followed a five-day strike by junior doctors, which marked the longest ever strike in NHS history. The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Imploring striking public sector workers to end their industrial action, PM Sunak offered a 6% rise, saying that was his last offer and no amount of strike could change his mind. The premier stressed that there will be no more negotiations over pay. Doctors called the government's offer a savage real-terms wage cut, putting more pressure on Sunak to rethink his government's stance over pay rises. The pressure by the Brits on Sunak and his government over wages and working conditions on the one hand, and unprecedented 40-year high inflation along with the scandals within the Conservative Party on the other, have already had their consequences on Tories. Sunak's popularity rating dropped to the lowest level since taking office. According to a poll conducted by YouGov, some 65% of Britons have an unfavorable view of the premier. That gives Sunak a net favorability rating of minus 40%. In the meantime, the Tories on Thursday lost two parliamentary seats in the country's by-elections to the Liberal Democrats in several cities, including Somerton and Frome. Those are among indications that if Sunak continues to maintain the policies of his predecessors, what the UK can brace for is even more severe consequences, not only for the Conservative Party, but maybe the whole UK public.
It's a despicable act, a sacrilegious one, the desecration of Islam's holiest book, the Quran, an act deemed okay under the Western notion of so-called freedom of expression. The protests are over the actions of an Iraqi refugee who burned pages of the Quran outside of Stockholm's main mosque last month. This time around, Salwan Mamika stepped on the Quran but did not burn it. He was responsible for promoting an event in Sweden for people to kick the Quran, which damaged the holy book. This act was enough to trigger renewed condemnations across the Muslim world. Protests broke out in many Muslim countries, from Iraq, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and Morocco, to Iran. Last time around, Muslim nations filed a motion at the UN Human Rights Body, calling on countries to review their laws and to plug gaps that may, quote, impede the prevention and prosecution of acts and advocacy of religious hatred.
Draft proposal L23, as already revised, is therefore adopted. Copies.
The UN Human Rights Council approved the resolution on religious hatred and bigotry. But as with all of the Council's resolutions, it is not legally binding.
In voting against the resolution, a message has been sent to billions of people of faith across the world that their commitment to prevent religious hatred is merely a lip service.
The 57-country Organization of Islamic Cooperation has said international law and other collective measures are needed to prevent future incidents involving the desecration of the Quran. Several Muslim countries have summoned Swedish envoys to convey their protest over the desecration of the Holy Quran. Iraq has already expelled the Swedish ambassador and has recalled its own envoy, while Iran says it will not admit a new Swedish ambassador.
We urge the Swedish and other European authorities to take urgent and effective measures. Mr. President, any doubts or delays in condemning and preventing such actions only reinforce perception of double standards and justify abuses of freedom of expression.
Leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has called on all Muslim states to expel Swedish envoys to show the world that they are united in rejecting any act of desecration against their sanctities. In order to prevent Sweden from allowing the Quran desecration to take place repeatedly, calls are growing for isolating the country, in which one move would be to boycott Swedish products. The burning of the Quran has been approved by the West under the banner of freedom of expression. Sweden's Deputy Prime Minister Ebba Busch of the Christian Democrats said, Sweden does not bend its back to Islam. Burning scriptures is reprehensible but not illegal. And this is what the U.S. reaction was on the previous incident. The U.S. State Department condemned the burning, but added that issuing the permit for the demonstration supported freedom of expression. Isn't that indirectly implying that it's okay to burn the Quran while displaying sympathy towards the sacrilegious act? Islamophobia, which is defined as the dislike of or prejudice against Islam or Muslims, remains a prevalent problem in the U.S., especially after the 9/11 attacks. Many incidents are testament to that. For example, in the U.S., Pastor Terry Jones organized a number of Quran burnings, sparking violence in West Asia and beyond. During U.S.'s occupation in Afghanistan, U.S. troops burned copies of the Quran by sending several books to the incinerator. Sam Basile, an Israeli who made the offensive film against Muslims, The Innocence of Muslims, enraged many Muslim countries. The filmmaker said, Islam is a cancer, period. And there's no denying that Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot, who made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim. And finally, who can forget Salman Rushdie, the man who provoked and offended the Muslim world, in which he exploited the freedom of expression in order to offend Muslim beliefs in his book, The Satanic Verses. European politicians are also guilty of Islamophobia. Dutch politician Geert Wilders of the Party of Freedom ran on a platform to reverse the Islamization of the Netherlands by closing mosques and Islamic schools, banning the Quran, banning Muslim migrants, and forbidding women from wearing headscarves. The French President Emmanuel Macron promoted the Islam of France, a brand of Islam to be particular to France, in an effort to reform Islam, which included the training of Islamic clerics and their funding to fit the French Western version of what Islam should be. These actions pose the question, are these anti-Islamic acts meant to dominate the religion's ideology and Muslims? After all, Muslims comprise an estimated 1.8 billion or more than 24% of the world population. The official religion in 26 countries in Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, and West Asia. Having dominance over the Muslim population in Western countries, especially, may be a concerted effort to marginalize Muslims in favor of the other white segments of the social strata. Provoking Muslims this way may be used as an excuse to accuse Muslims of violence and, in turn, extremism. The Israeli President Isaac Herzog has visited the United States and was welcomed by the U.S. establishment, including President Biden and senior congressmen. But a number of U.S. lawmakers, frustrated with the racist policies of the Israeli regime toward Palestinians, boycotted Herzog's speech to the U.S. Congress. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, and Nydia Velasquez, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, skipped the address. Ilhan Omar, an African-American congresswoman, was the first to make such a decision. In a tweet, Omar said the invitation, which comes during the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank history, sends a wrong signal at a wrong time.
So let's just begin by setting up the context that this is 2023 in the aftermath of the legacy human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations, UN committees, UN agencies, as well as multiple scholars and independent investigations have all concluded that Israel oversees an apartheid regime.
The Israeli regime barred Omar and Palestinian-born Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from visiting the occupied territories in 2019 over their support for Palestinian rights and membership in the Anti-Israel Caucus. Rights advocates have said that Herzog's visit has been a boost to the unquestionable U.S. support for Israel at a time when many of them are asking Biden to pressure Netanyahu's cabinet to end abuses against Palestinians.
And let's just get this record straight here. This is not something that's made up. The United Nations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Israel's own largest human rights organization, B'Tselem, all agree that Israel is an apartheid state. To assert otherwise, Mr. Speaker, in the face of this just body of evidence is an attempt to deny the reality and to normalize violence of apartheid. Israel is an apartheid state. The government is deeply problematic in the way that they are proceeding in the structure of oppression.
The boycott has signaled increasing tensions among Democrats over the unwavering support of the U.S. establishment toward Israel, Tensions between House Democrats reached a boiling point after Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, described Israel as a racist state while speaking at a conference in Chicago.
I want you to know that we have been fighting to make it clear that Israel is a racist state, that the Palestinian people deserve self-determination and autonomy, that the dream of a two-state solution is slipping away from us.
Following the remarks of Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, resolution was approved by the U.S. House of Representatives that voiced support for the Israeli regime. The resolution turned a blind eye to the crimes that were recently committed by Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank and ignored frequent settler violence against the people of Palestine. Israeli settlers also frequently attack Palestinian towns and villages under the protection of the Israeli military forces. Israel has been practicing an apartheid regime, a system of extreme racial segregation of people against Palestinians since 1948. That year, the regime claimed existence across Palestine after a Western-backed war, during which tens of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes, villages were depopulated, and thousands were killed.
The United States is not just a bystander here. The United States is complicit and a pillar of Israeli apartheid in its provision on unequivocal financial, diplomatic, and military support. That but for that support, Israel could not sustain this regime, which is not surprising at all, because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid.
The world's prominent rights groups have already raised the alarm that the occupying regime is morphing into an apartheid system that gives Palestinians second-class status and is designed to maintain Zionist hegemony from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. The Israeli oppression of Palestinians has witnessed a sharp rise under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition cabinet, which is composed of far-right Zionist parties that oppose Palestinian statehood and support the expansion of settlements. Internally, the Israeli regime has also witnessed growing rifts and fragmentations, and the right-wing cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pushing ahead with his controversial judicial overhaul plans. Just days ago, hundreds of reservists held a protest rally in Tel Aviv and vowed to no longer report for duty in protest against Netanyahu's proposed judicial changes. Protest organizers believe the increasing involvement of reservists would be a game-changer that could make Netanyahu scrap his game. The drive by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet to change the judiciary system and to strip the Supreme Court of some of its powers has sparked unprecedented protests in Israel since January.
واحد دشنا باري لبتشنا باري لبتشنا باري لبتشنا.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry, water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence, it breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, 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 Hussein,
Hossein, 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 I cry for you in pain. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام مرارة الدنيا حلاوة الآخرة وحلاوة الدنيا مرارة الآخرة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The sourness of this world is the sweetness of the next world, while the sweetness of this world is the sourness of the next one."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIP English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the things that we find in this universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea of keeping an oath, about keeping a promise. Now, this is really something that is important, and the more you talk about it, the more you realize how important it is. Now, just to kind of start off, you know, sometimes, you know, we have this idea in our minds that, well, you know, keeping a promise means that you kind of have a contractual promise, right? So, for example, either you write down somewhere, I promise that I will do so and so. Well, that's a promise. Well, of course, that's a promise. Now, on the other hand, you actually verbally, for example, say, I promise that I will do so-and-so, or that I won't do so-and-so, right? And of course, that's also a promise. But sometimes there's very subtle ways of promising things that we don't take into consideration. So we say that, you know, yeah, don't worry about it, I'll do such-and-such. Or yeah, don't worry about it, I won't do that, you know? Or for example, well, I guess that is an example right there. Now, these were promises. This was a kind of oath that you have given to somebody, and you have to fulfill that oath. It's really interesting, in many places and in many traditions and many sayings, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talked about this and he really emphasized this idea of keeping our promises. And so when an infallible emphasizes to such an extent a certain something, whatever that is, that shows you the importance of that thing. And here we're talking about keeping promises to the point where Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that promises are like chains that will be around our necks on the day of resurrection, on the day of Qiyamah. And so these promises that we make in this world, they will be, as we said, these chains on the day of Qiyamah, on the day of judgment. And if we fulfill those promises in this world, then we will be free of those chains. But if we don't fulfill those promises, these chains will stay upon us, and of course it will make the day of judgment much more difficult and harder for us. May Allah protect us and forgive us, not only on that day, but in this world as well, if we haven't kept our promises. And it makes sense, dear brothers and sisters. Promises that are made are this fundamental aspect of society, you know. And so, for example, when promises are broken, then you will find that slowly but surely, not only will the family, at the family level, at the societal level, and at the communal level, at the community level, at the national level, at the global level, at every single one of these levels, the system and the order and the discipline will break down. Why will it break down? Because promises are being broken. So, for example, I promise to pay somebody on a certain day. Now, that person is relying on that promise. That person that goes and then promises and guarantees something else to someone else, and then that person to someone else, and then that person to someone else. And so promises create a domino effect. If you aren't able to do something, please make sure and let the other person know that there's a likelihood or there's a chance that it might not happen. But if you promise something, then try your best to abide by your promises. Inshallah, may the Almighty Allah help us and protect us. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Ziyara بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
It must have been very important for Ali to make wasiyyat and address it to all. This was not the normal wasiyyat that a person makes about himself and his family and what is to be done with my estate after I pass away. This is a wasiyyat which has been included in Nahj al-Balagha by Sayyid Razi in the third section of the book, part of, you know, the short sayings. This is number 47. And there he mentions advices for us. Then he says, Wallahu Wallahu fi jiranikum. He says, remember Allah regarding your neighbors, because your Nabi used to do the prayer, the advice about kindness to neighbors to the extent, ظَنَّنَّ أَنَّهُ سَيُوَرِّثُهُمْ. We thought a time will come that he will make the neighbors part of the group of the heirs, that they also will have part of the estate. That was the emphasis that the Prophet had about kindness to the neighbors. Then Ali comes to what is known as specific religious matters. He says, وَاللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ فِي الْقُرْآنِ لَا يُسْبِقُكُمْ بِالْعَمَلِ بِهِ غَيْرُكُمْ. He says, I remind you of Allah. I remind you of Allah regarding the Qur'an. It shouldn't happen that others go ahead of you in acting on the Qur'an. Yes, we read the Qur'an. Yes, we make sure our children learn how to read the Qur'an properly. We go to the process of having our makhraj correct. We even go to the extent of memorizing the surah of the Qur'an. These are all good things. But all these things are just like doing wudu and then not doing namaz. In relation to Quran, what is that act of namaz? Al-amal bihi. To act, to live according to Quran. Everything we learn about Quran, recitation, makhraj, tafsir, memorization, everything is there so that we may be able to act and live by the Quran. And it's amazing that when Ali says, لَا يُسْبِقُكُمْ بِالْعَمَلْ بِهِ غَيْرُكُمْ, he's warning us, saying that it shouldn't be that others go ahead of you. It means there is a possibility that others might look at the Quran, learn lessons from it, and implement it in their own lives. Whereas we would just have the Quran, but there was no implementation.